Now I have to make aesthetic decisions and I'm scared. Oh no! And the show started. Uh-oh. I'm scared. Uh-oh. Help.
And the show started. I'm scared. Hey everybody, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. None of us is as smart as all of us on this podcast. That's just a fact.
That is right. Although today we are going to pretend at the smartness with help from our wonderful crew of producers. I'm Molly Wood. It's What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, an entire episode dedicated to answering your questions as best we gosh darn can.
Yeah. So lots of questions about GameStop, which is, as you may have heard, also on Marketplace today, by the way, the subject of a whole lot of activity and dare one say frenzy in the stock market. The very short thing explanation here that Molly did the other day, but just to refresh, lots of people on Reddit decided to pile into this stock, lots of retail investors, which squeezed a lot of big hedge fund people who thought GameStop stock was going to go down. And thus, with that stock up 1,700% since the beginning of the year, some really big names on Wall Street are getting squeezed. And there's much rejoicing among retail investors and much consternation and conversation among regular Wall Street types. Anyway, which gets us to the question of, it comes from Kurt here in California. He says, how is GameStop different from penny stock scams of old? Two questions in there, right? One is about penny stocks and the other one is about scams, right? So penny stocks are not quite pennies. They are traded in what's called over-the-counter market. That is to say, they are not subject to the regulation and scrutiny of regular exchanges, which do take some care to make sure that the companies that are trading their stocks on them are actually bona fide companies. They're also extremely cheap, under $5, usually well under $5, like literally in the penny category. But they were, for a long time, easily manipulated and pumped up and then dumped. Not like a lot. I mean, it's not like you're running a penny stock up to $155, but you run a penny stock up to a dime, literally a penny stock. That's, you know, a tenfold increase and you can make some money on there. Yep. That's not what this is. It's an actual company. It's an actual company.
Yep.
You know?
It's because GameStop stock is so important. Yeah. I mean, like, I feel like the one thing that we should make super clear here is this is not a scam.
Right, the benefits
of this are broadly distributed. People are making real money. In some cases, you're seeing like literal heartwarming posts on Twitter of people who are like, thank you, I'm able to support my mother and my sister through this pandemic because I made $50,000. Or I got in with, you know, a limit to get out so I could pay for my dog's surgery. Like, people are making real money. Everything that is happening near as we can tell is legal. It's all happening out in the open. Yep. Like, hey, everybody, go buy this stock. So I think that's probably the primary difference is that it's not a scam. It's just playing with the rules.
I think that's exactly right. As far as we know, right? So if there were some big hedge fund guys under the guise of a Redditor, you know, that's GUYS versus GUYSE, right? Then that's a whole different ballgame. But as far as we know, this is legal. The other thing we have to keep in mind here, though, is that at the end of this, because it will end, because all these, you know, panics and bubbles and frenzies do end, somebody is going to be left holding the bag.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just
We should probably note, absolutely. And we should also note that this is, you know, the GameStop specific frenzy may end, but it has now moved on to AMC, BlackBerry, Nokia, Fossil. There's actually sort of a fascinating part of it that's like the nostalgia stocks. And when you look at the ones they're picking, you can kind of be like, oh, so they're exactly my age. Like, exactly. I think Blockbuster was in the mix for a minute.
Funny.
You know, you're like 90s kids. Okay, I see you.
Right.
But yes, exactly. Apparently, there was like a lot of pressure not to sell GameStop because nobody wanted the price to go down, which means that at some point somebody is going to be like, I don't know, you told me not to sell, but it keeps going down. And they're going to, there will always be people who don't make money out of all of this. It is a dangerous game to play. But right now, I mean, the people who are making money are very happy about it. And, you know, considering how many years we've only seen like hedge funds and big banks make money, there's also a lot of sort of like glee and schadenfreude all over the internet.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody texted me earlier really and said, like, it's, I mean, it really, nobody feels sorry for hedge funds. Like, nobody.
Right.
Sorry. No one does. Somebody texted me earlier and said, can we just write a piece of code that just writes stonks in all caps every time somebody complains about this happening?
Yeah.
Stonks, yeah. Of course, being the slang.
Totally.
Stock advice.
Just remember, losses can get to 100%. That's all you need to know. Right. Upside is huge. Losses can be 100%. That's all I need to say. Okay.
Exactly. So just play all you want, but be careful. Yeah. Love mom.
Dude, right, I didn't yes. Wait, hold on. I didn't tell you this story. I meant to Slack it to the group, but I didn't. But anyway, I'll just do it now on the pod. So I'm walking the dogs this morning, and my rear end buzzes, and it's my phone, obviously, and it's a text in the family chat from my oldest son, who says in the family chat, now remember, he's out of college. He says, hey, quick, put all the kids' college accounts in GameStop and AMC stock. And I wrote him back, and he was kidding. I wrote him back, and I said, please, 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 please tell me you do not have a Robinhood account. And a nanosecond later comes a screenshot of his Robinhood account.
Of his Robinhood account, and totally.
And then he says, I'm only in it a little way. I've gained $4 in the last week and a half. And I'm like, oh, God, you're killing me, man.
Dude, FOMO is strong. FOMO is strong.
Yeah, a little bit.
Just tell him to make a limit. Yeah.
That's right.
Fascinating. Yeah, it's gonna get friends. This ride is not over.
Yeah, for
not
sure.
By a long shot. But let's talk about Congress, shall we? Democrats hold 50 seats in the Senate. Perhaps you had heard they do not, however, as you've perhaps also heard, hold a filibuster-proof majority. Meaning, if they don't get bipartisan support for the big initiatives, then in theory they're going to need to come up with a Plan B, and that Plan B means making friends with Republicans. That brings us to this question from Reed in Seattle.
Considering the evenly divided Senate, it has become very clear that the filibuster will play a huge part in whether or not Joe Biden can get through Congress the bills he needs to implement his agenda. Budget reconciliation is, I know, one of the only ways to get around this, but I am not at all clear how this works or when it can be invoked. Can you make me smart about this? Thanks for all that you do.
That's a good one.
This is a wonky one.
A read. Mm-hmm. Yeah, read. That's a good one. Okay, so we're going to be super not wonky here and extremely high level so that you know what's going on as all of this happens over the next 6 weeks, because this is how all of that stuff is going to get through, because the Dems will not have 60 votes to beat the filibuster. So budget reconciliation is a parliamentary maneuver in the Senate of the United States, which allows for, on bills involving revenue and expenditure, only to pass with 51 votes. It's really important that you understand that it is revenue and expenses only, and that the Senate parliamentarian gets to decide this. So as Biden goes forward with trying to get bills passed under budget reconciliation, which, just as a little foreshadowing, I think he's obviously going to have to do, there are some things in there that he's not going to be able to do under reconciliation. Can he do, a change to taxes? Yes, conceivably he could. Republicans did that in 2017. He could not, however, do something like the $15 minimum wage, because that does not necessarily affect revenue and spending on the part of the Senate. So, it's really
taxes?
Tricky.
You can't really.
Yeah, I don't know. Good question.
Yeah.
Good question.
Hmm.
But it's,
I guess
it's
we may find
super
out,
wonky.
Right?
Yeah, we're gonna, right? Because he's totally gonna try, and as well he should. But that's kind of the nutshell of the whole thing. It's really specific. It's really limited, and also it just blows bipartisanship out of the water, because people will say, you did it with budget reconciliation. That's terrible. And you're like, but it's the rules, man.
Yeah, totally. Yep. I'm trying to stay away from we're trying to stay away from filibuster because it's not our show, but it's just the whole thing is really fascinating, and a question of how do you get Congress working when between partisanship and a system that we have that seems to reward status quo, it's hard to get it working.
Yeah. Yeah. For those of you who are interested in this, which again, Molly is completely right, we will not delve into, low though I may want to. Adam Gentleson, who used to be on the staff of Harry Reid in the Senate, has a new book out called Kill Switch, all about the filibuster and the history of it in the Senate. It's totally fascinating.
Ooh, I'm going to get it.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's really good. Wonkarama. Yeah. I have already, just so you know, for the record, I have already made a formal request in our Slack channel to name this episode Stonks and Wonks. Which should probably be a spin-off podcast.
I totally like that.
All right. Back to the questions at hand.
Steve in Michigan, he emailed, and here's what he says. Can you please delve into the, at first glance, conflicting actions between Google's proposed actions in Australia and France? It is threatening, he writes, to pull out of Australia, but it's complying with the French law for news outlets in its, quote, news showcase. I have somehow missed this entire story.
Oh, yeah. It's a big one. Big one. Possibly no more Google in Australia. Yes. Wow. So, of course, the backstory here is that thanks to Google and Facebook, which own a combined 80-something percent of global digital advertising, news publishers are in trouble. And increasingly, most consumers get their news either from Google or Facebook. But those are, of course, like links to news stories. And so these news outlets and publishers, organizations have band together and said, like, hey, you should pay us for this, right? You've taken all of our revenue, and now you're taking our stories and delivering them up to people. And in Google's case, you're presenting them in a way that means consumers don't have to click through. In a lot of cases, they can see like a little piece of the story plus the headline and move on, and the newspaper never even gets a click and an ad impression. So Google struck a deal in France where France had said, you're going to have to pay publishers for content. And Google was like, no, we'll leave. And then they came up with an agreement basically in which Google would pay news publishers for those snippets. So if you do a search on Google and you get a New York Times result and it says, you know, the headline is like, stonks go crazy, Redditors ruin Wall Street. And then you get like a little subhead about it. You know, this is more complicated than it appears on a million levels. You feel like you're up on the story and you move on, and Google's like, it's cool, Le Monde, we paid you for that. Australia, it's very different. They would be paying for search results that just contain links to news stories. And, you know, Google's argument, and Facebook's too in a way, although Google's the one that specifically is saying they're might going to leave over it, is this is the foundation of the internet. The World Wide Web was invented on the idea that you can link from one page to another page, and that this would make the, you know, foundation of the internet go away. That probably isn't a great argument when you get down to the actual entirety of the business models here, and the fact that, you know, digital advertising is the business model and these sites are getting decimated. But it is not a super simple argument, and it's made even more complicated by the fact that Google and Facebook seem to understand that this is a problem and have created grants for news publishers. So they're paying news outlets in the form of these grants, and you know, it's a lot of money. It's hundreds of million dollars, but it's not as much as they're losing from digital advertising revenue. So this again is like a story that's not going to go away. It's going to go on for a long time.
Do you think Google actually leaves Australia? I mean, you know, they've pulled out of other countries, I suppose. So, you know,
they have. Yeah. I mean, I suppose that they could. And, you know, I don't know that it would be. It's not a small country, obviously, but I don't know that, you know, I don't think it's kind of like, it's not a death blow for Google to leave either.
Right. Right.
So
right.
I assume that they would. I mean, this is, you know, people have been saying for years, including me, I think this was one of my predictions one time, was that we would enter this period of a much more balkanized internet. Yeah. And I think there are plenty of countries who say, you know, and would be willing to say like, yeah, we'd be better off without Facebook, or we'd love to incubate a local version of Google and have, you know, that be homegrown.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. So maybe.
Hmm. Okay.
A lot of ball game left. Finally, we got this voice memo from our favorite thing, from Dave in Texas.
I was wondering why stock market numbers are reported by news organizations multiple times a day. As we all know, the stock market is not a reflection of the economy. I am a market participant. However, I only look at my portfolio once a quarter, if that. I care a great deal more about interest rates, employment numbers, consumer spending, etc. So why do news organizations bother?
So let's lay it out here, Dave, shall we? You're talking about the NPR hourly newscast, right? Because Marketplace does the numbers, and I'll explain that in a minute. But I don't actually know why on the National Public Radio hourly newscasts and at the bottom of the hour, they do stock market changes throughout the day, unless there's something big happening. Like today, it was newsworthy that GameStop was up 135% because of all the brouhaha, right? And on any given day, like a day where there's a big plane crash and another Boeing airplane falls out of the sky, you could say Boeing shares are down, you know, XYZ percent today, and here's why that matters, right? I don't know, though, why they do it on an hourly basis. Maybe just habit.
Right.
We do it at Marketplace for two reasons. Number one, the 45 seconds that we allot for the numbers in the program every day is what we call the accordion. So if we need to make up time or trim time from the broadcast, because we've only got 28 minutes and 45 seconds, the numbers are the opportunity for us to do that, right? We can do the numbers at 20 seconds. We can do the numbers at a minute five, right? And make the show end at 28 minutes and 45 seconds after it started, because that's how much time we have. So that's number one. Number two is that we've actually changed the numbers on Marketplace lately, right? We're not just doing straight stock market reports. We are adding, and I will tell you, this came from Rafael Bostic, the president of the Atlanta Fed, who, when I interviewed him, said, hey, you guys got to cut that out, man. Don't just do straight numbers. Do numbers that, you know, the 50% of Americans who are not in the stock market will want to know about. And so we do stuff like the price of gas. We do stuff like, I mean, all kinds of stuff. It changes every day. And the editors who write the numbers at Marketplace do a really good job in sort of diversifying that. We're also not doing them at the end of the show anymore, right? It's one indicator. It serves a functional purpose for the show. And at times, a useful extra item of news for the audience. So that's Marketplace.
Yeah,
I don't know about NPR. Go figure. That's where I am.
Yeah, but to your point, Dave, like, it's a conversation. It's a real conversation within Marketplace. Real editorial decisions have been made about it, and I think they show up and they make sense. And frankly, it makes more sense for our show to do stock market numbers because we're also a business show, an economic show. So that part of the economy is, you know, the bailiwick. But I love that you explained the accordion part. I was really wondering if you were going to go all the way behind the curtain, and that's such a good. It's like my favorite thing. Yep. The accordion. We get a lot done. Today we went all the way to 17 minutes.
We don't waste any time.
We do not waste time, friends. We're efficient people. That's it for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. We'll be back tomorrow. Status of hollowed out shell, unclear. Keep sending.
TBD.
TBD. Keep sending your questions and your comments to makemesmart@marketplace.org. Emails are good, but voice memos are even better.
They're so much better. And really, don't pay attention to the sound of your own voice. Honestly, just throw it out.
Don't listen.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Never edit.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and our smart speaker skill. Did you see that tweet, by the way, that went by that said, why is Tony Wagner a digital producer? Isn't everybody digital? How much analog stuff do you guys have going on anyway?
I know, that cracked me up. I was going to write back and be like, I cut tape every day, friend.
Yeah.
Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. That's not true, any of that about the tape, even the digital kind. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Donna Tam is the senior producer, and the executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves. Now we got to change two things. You already changed the numbers. Now we got to change the digital thing.
I know, right?
Sheesh.
Tony Wagner's
tech is everything.
Stop. Full stop. That's right.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.